This is the PT Pintcast, a podcast that talks about physical therapy over beer, bringing together clinicians, researchers, and forward-thinking PTs in a show that's anything but boring.
Let there be beer!
This is the PT Pintcast with your host, Jimmy McKay.
The best conversations happen at happy hour. Welcome to ours. Thanks to everybody who's been following us on Facebook and Twitter at PT Pintcast. Sharing the identity of the show is the only way people find out about us, so thank you for all that. Now on Instagram, if for any reason you wanted to see pictures of us, which you shouldn't, we're on there at PT_Pintcast. Today, we're talking to Kyle Ridgway. Kyle received a degree in neuroscience from Pomona College and a DPT from the University of Colorado, Denver. Currently, he's the coordinator of Physical Therapy Quality Improvement Project in the Medical Intensive Care Unit at the University of Colorado Hospital. Well known on social media for his critical assessments and skeptical inquiry, he writes at PT Think Tank, where his goal is to provide valuable insights and thought-provoking considerations. But of course, that's just his opinion. In his free time, you'll find him drinking strong coffee, hop forward IPAs, and descending hills on two wheels or two skis. Kyle, welcome to the PT Pintcast.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm sure the pleasure will be mostly mine.
All right, first question is always the hardest. What are we drinking tonight?
What tonight we are drinking, of course, a Colorado brew, being from Denver. And I'm drinking an Avery Raja Double IPA, the prince of IPAs, as it were.
Ooh, I like that a lot. I'm going with a gift I just got, trying to get through the six-pack. It's called Stacy's Mom. It's an India Citrus Pale Ale. Got it as a birthday present. Still a student, so if you get a gift of beer, you keep going through it as slow as you can.
Keep that stuff flowing, right?
Absolutely. So I started following you on Twitter, and that's kind of where you find a lot of PT conversations. You can check out Kyle at Dr_Ridge_DPT. That is his Twitter handle, and you can just kind of peek into conversations, which is always kind of cool. So that's kind of where I came across, and Twitter can stir up some different conversations with different people. So what stuff did you want to talk about?
But I always want to talk about acute care. Maybe we can start there.
So let's start there. So the necessity and value of acute care PT, from pre-professional education to advocacy. It's a specialized area of PT. It takes a special kind of person. You got to pay real close attention because people could die. You have to pay attention. I mean, I guess people could die in any setting in PT, but I guess
it's true.
You're trying to get them medically stable at that point, so you got to be real careful. So what brought you to acute care? Did you know it when you were a student or what?
That's a great question, of course, and it's an interesting story. I always think it's a funny story for me. When I would came into PT school, my goal was always to do sports, manual therapy, and own my own practice. I was an ortho guy. I was a manual therapy, American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapist and Special Interest Group. That's what I wanted to do. Dead set on orthopedics, and I wanted to work with athletes, and I wanted to open my own practice. I was into manual therapy. I was in the manual therapy student special interest group and all that stuff. I wanted to avoid any hospital rotation. You know, but thankfully, every course that I took in PT school, my interest in that area of practice was kind of, my eyes were open to it, and I became very interested in it. And my school, thankfully, kind of mandated we had this field work semester where once a week you had to go to a clinical site, and you had to do 5 weeks in an inpatient site and 5 weeks in an outpatient site. And I was at an acute care hospital, and I was just dreading it the whole time before it came. And to be honest with you, I was scared. I was nervous. I didn't know what it was going to be about. Even the first couple of days, I was just in over my head, so confused. What is the chart? What all does this stuff mean? You know, it was like being in a different country without an interpreter.
I know that feeling. I had to do a little bit in acute care, and I was feeling the exact same thing.
Luckily, you know, if you're in it long enough, I've been doing it for 5 years now, you start to pick up the language a little bit. So I'm feeling a little better. About the third or fourth day, I realized, wow, I'm really liking this. I mean, this is really neat. I'm really interested in this. Gave me pause for sure. And then the second kind of big thing in my schooling was we had the opportunity at my program to do a research affiliation, where half of your time is in clinic and half of your time is with one of your professors, kind of being a research assistant, helping them with their projects, you know, kind of learning about being an academic, learning about research. I'd already had an outpatient orthopedic clinical set up for one of my long clinicals, so I had to do a different setting. And one of my professors was just starting collecting some pilot data on early intensive physical therapy for patients who were mechanically ventilated at that time for more than 7 days and were likely to develop ICU-acquired weakness. And so I was paired with her, and then I was at a long-term acute care hospital for my affiliation and just really got a passion for it. You know, as they say, the rest is history, and my career kind of took a right-hand turn at that point. And, you know, for a while, for about 3 years, I actually practiced in a small private clinic and University of Colorado Hospital on the inpatient side, rotating through all units and the ICUs, and then kind of took the plunge a couple of years ago to go full time and really kind of started diving into the intensive care unit stuff a little bit more. And now I've had the opportunity to help coordinate a quality improvement project. So all by luck, as it were, coincidence. So.
Yeah, we hear that a lot. A lot of students come in and I'm going to be a peds PT or I'm going to be an ortho. And, you know, I guess our professors have just heard it and seen it so many times where someone comes in, guns blazing, I'm going to do this. And sometimes they do. And then sometimes they don't.
For sure. And I mean, it's one of those things that definitely okay to have those goals and that forward vision and that kind of those career development milestones ahead of you. But, you know, really being open to these other areas of practice can really be of huge, huge benefit as you're developing. And even if you don't end up going into that area of practice, when you're in it, if you have an affill there during that class, to just dive in full steam. And what I used to always tell people is, hey, you want to be an orthopedic physical therapist? You're going to do great in your ortho class. You're going to love ortho. You need to work really hard in your neuro class and your cardiopulm class. That's where you need to pay attention. The ortho stuff's going to come. Delving into that other stuff is just such a value, though, such a value.
Talking with some neuro PTs just on this podcast and talking with some ortho PTs on the podcast and just out at conferences, and they kind of sing the same tune. They're like, all of your neuro patients are going to have muscles and bones, and all your ortho patients are going to have a nervous system and a brain. You're going to have to know how to use some treatments that'll work in both arenas.
And don't forget the heart and the lungs.
Yes. How can I forget cardiopulm? Those two. Yeah. Got to have one of those. The role of science in PT practice. What is science? It's a very simple question. I thought I'd be able to answer it, but maybe I can't.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not technically a scientist, so you know, I'm obviously a little bit in the land of conjecture as well, but I'll tell you what I know, and I think sometimes it's mischaracterized. So I think we always think of science as research, but really science at its foundation is a body of knowledge, but also you can talk about the scientific method. But really what science is predicated on is the ability to make predictions. And your field or your area of study, which is usually an ology, right? Biology,
right.
Neurology, the study of, isn't at the level of science yet until it can make really, really robust predictions where the hypothesis can make a prediction. And then you can test those predictions. So that's not a bad thing. You know, because sometimes people get mad and say, well, you're saying that's not a science. Well, no, it's just it's using the scientific method. It's using research. It's just not yet to the level of a science where it's a body of knowledge that can make really, really robust predictions like we can in physics, like we can in even chemistry, even some physiology. But every step you go away from those fields, the mathematics becomes less certain and the complexity becomes orders of magnitude more complex. If you talk about physics, chemistry, biology, physiology, neuroscience, which should really be called neurology technically, the complexity is orders of magnitude higher. And so the mathematical certainty becomes a little bit lower.
So where does that come into play in PT practice? I imagine that's where it comes into play because very few things are 100% certain every time.
Absolutely. That being able to understand and recognize the uncertainty, especially when you're talking about dealing with a human in a complex environment, whatever setting you work in. And then the flip side is understanding the philosophy of science or how science works and what it's predicated on, what it's based on. And, you know, we always talk about to prove this right. That's not science. Science is all about falsifiability. And before that, you still have all your work behind you because you need to come up with a theory or a hypothesis that is testable and can make predictions. And then you try to falsify it. Good illustration of this concept is what's called the black swan effect. So if you wanted to prove that all swans were white, you could collect data for years on white swans, and you could have a million data points on white swans. And all it takes for me is to find one valid and reliable black swan, and
done.
Your white swan theory is over. The reason that this is important in PT practice, I think, is we need to broaden our view of what we talk about when we talk about evidence-based practice. Physics is evidence-based practice. Physiology is evidence-based practice. Psychology is evidence-based practice. Basic science is evidence-based practice. Whether or not something is physically, mathematically, physiologically, psychologically plausible is almost nearly as important as whether or not there's RCT level support for it. And so we got to have the plausibility before the RCT, because you can do an RCT on craniosacral therapy, for example, and it may very well come up positive versus a no treatment group or even a placebo group, maybe, depending on how the trial is designed. And I ask students this all the time, well, would you use craniosacral therapy? And they say, well, no way. I say, why not? They say, well, it doesn't make any sense. And we need to apply that same level of scrutiny to the interventions that we use and really kind of understand that there's much more to evidence-based or science-based practice than an RCT.
Okay. So let's see. My acute care professor hammered home acute care is deathly important. And I believe she used those exact words. From ICU acquired weakness on, she made sure we were on our toes and she cares about it a lot. So what do you usually tell students, other PTs or people who aren't in PT about acute care PT?
You know, people who aren't in PT are always a bit taken aback when you say, oh, you're a physical therapist. Like, you know, do you work with strokes? Do you work with kids? Do you work with athletes? And so, well, I work in an intensive care unit in a hospital. And the question always, well, what do you do? My reply usually is, well, physical therapy mostly. But, you know, and then I explain that kind of what my role is within acute care. But I think for students, what I hammer home is that regardless of where you want to practice, having an affiliation or exposure to acute care gives you a couple of things that are really, really important. The first one is you actually get to see how healthcare runs. You get to see the boots on the ground in and out of healthcare in a team hospital-based environment. And that is remarkably important for developing communication, developing triage skills, developing teamwork skills on an interdisciplinary team. There's no other setting that relies more heavily on that. Subsequently, you get to see actual sick people, which is highly important. A, to understand how you can move them, but B, to also see kind of what I would call pathophysiology at work. You get to see what someone who has an acute exacerbation of a chronic illness looks like. You get to see someone who has remarkable physiologic derangements. And that becomes important when you talk about medical screening in all the other different settings. The third is you get a better appreciation for some of the other things that PTs maybe aren't experts on, medications, pathophysiology, differential diagnosis, all these other things that we're not necessarily the absolute experts on. And it gives you a real appreciation for what you don't know. And it really lets you know how important some of these other things are. For professionals, the thing that I always bring up, especially to outpatient PTs, is that I will talk to more physicians tomorrow within the first hour that I'm in the hospital. I will see more of them than you will probably talk to all next year. The reason I bring that up is I think, unfortunately, we kind of left our acute care colleagues behind when we had this direct access charge. And they were the ones that could have gotten this done for us the quickest.
And what do you mean by that?
Because from an advocacy standpoint, if we really want to affect what physicians think of us, we need to tackle them where they get trained. And where they get trained is in acute care hospitals and residencies and fellowships.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we can build up our acute care therapists to practice and advocate for physical therapy at a very, very high level in acute care hospitals, we have all of our work behind us. It's going to be an easy tide to come over because physicians and physicians in training are used to interacting with this type of physical therapist. Because I can tell you the interesting thing is, if you know, I went to my ICU physician colleagues and I said, what do you think? Do you think a physical therapist in a private clinic should have direct access to someone with low back pain? They would chuckle and they would say, well, yeah, why? I mean, I let you see all my patients and I don't tell you what to do. And we talk, right. These are the sickest patients in healthcare. So yeah, of course, absolutely. Trust you guys. And we can use some of these physicians as advocates, especially the ER physicians, the critical care physicians, our hospitalist colleagues who really interact with us a lot in the hospital, could be big advocates for us outside the hospital. I think we've really missed an opportunity to bring on a powerful group of collaborators.
That's a good point. Why did we miss the boat on that?
I think there's a couple of reasons. Physical therapy, like any profession, has a tendency to get siloed and specialized and fractured.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to see why the other settings are important and why how they're all interactive and what we can all learn from each other. And so sometimes it's hard for outpatient therapists to realize why an acute therapist may be an important advocator. And then the flip side is it's sometimes hard for the acute care physical therapist to understand why direct access may be an important professional issue. And I've talked with a lot of acute therapists like, well, that doesn't apply to me. You know, I work in a hospital and we're, you know, we're a consult service, just like any other non-primary service. So we get consulted when people want us on the case for the most part. The thing that I always come back to is the direct access mindset. What's the mindset of direct access? And I'll ask them a few questions, you know, like, you know, have you ever caught something and brought it to the doc? Or what do you screen for in this population before you mobilize, before you walk someone, before you get them out of bed? And they tell me and they go through and they explain, oh, you know, I've caught this and I saw this one time and I brought it up to the physician. I said, you're practicing as a direct access provider. The way that you are practicing, the way you're thinking, the way your clinical decision-making goes, your communication, you practice with a direct access mindset. And that's what matters. And so I think we had to take the logistics out of it and look more philosophically on what it meant to the profession.
That's a good point. I mean, if you put it that way, it would have been easier to convince the other half of the equation, the physicians, on where we can be direct access practitioners by doing it that way.
Yeah, I mean, and it's very interesting. But the other piece is vital signs. You understand why vital signs are important when you've been in a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And the flip side is you'll learn how to take them and interpret them a little bit better.
Yeah, we had this conversation in our differential diagnosis class just a couple of weeks ago where we want to hold the PT profession as direct access providers now that we've earned it. But now we need to uphold the other half of our bargain that we made, which was we're going to make sure that we screen everybody for what we said we were going to screen them for and make sure that we don't get anything that gets past us.
Yeah.
And if we're not taking vitals, there's a chance that something's going to get past us.
If I was a physician, which of course I'm not, my biggest argument against PT direct access would be the low rate of vital signs taking in the outpatient setting. There's no other place in healthcare that you actually enter the healthcare system where the first thing they do is not give you a previous health history form and take your vital signs. Doesn't matter if it's your neurologist, your cardiologist, your PCP, the ER. If you are accessing the healthcare system, even the dentist takes vital signs now. I mean, mm-hmm. Give me a break, right? Where they don't take your vital signs. You are not an access point into the healthcare system if you don't take vital signs, and I fundamentally believe that as a first point of entry.
We talked about one possible reason being that students wind up practicing like their clinical instructors. So if we go out as students and we have this bestowed upon us, this knowledge that we need to take vital signs by our professors, and then we show up the first day of clinic and our CI isn't doing it, I don't know. I'm a pretty outgoing guy, but I don't know if I would tell my CI, I'm going to start taking vitals even though you don't. I can see where that would be an awkward situation. So you sit there, you do your 8 or 12 weeks and you learn, but I don't know how many students would go out of their way to say, hey, this is really important. I think we should be doing it. And I think you should do it in your practice. I mean, I don't know how many students would say, I'm going to teach you something. But maybe that's where some of the loss is, the translation from PT school to PT practice. Maybe that's where it is.
I mean, I think that's definitely part of it. And, you know, even if you had a clinical where you take a lot of vital signs in the outpatient setting and you're doing really nice cardiovascular screening, if you go into a clinic and now all of a sudden, you know, you don't have an automatic BP cuff, you don't have a pulse oximeter, it's not built into the flow of the clinic, it's not seen as important, it's very easy for that stuff to fall to the wayside. And so, you know, I think it's one of those things where no one's to blame and everyone's to blame at the same time, you know, mm-hmm. paradoxically. You know, I think as an individual practitioner or even a student, you know, you can push back against that chaos a little bit at a time. And, you know, as a clinical instructor, I don't expect my students to be exactly like me. You know, as clinical instructors should be open to a student doing things a bit differently. And, you know, taking vital signs is not by any means an offensive or controversial part of a treatment session. You know, and I think if that's something a student does a little more than a CI, I mean, I don't think a student should feel bad about saying, hey, you know, I want to try this. I know you don't do it. Like, let's give it a shot. And I don't think the student should feel bad about that. And I think the clinical instructor, the onus is on them to grow and to put that into context and try to feel out why the student's doing that. And I think it's totally okay, totally reasonable. But socially, it's hard.
Yeah.
Hierarchical relationship, this person passes you or fails you, and now you're saying, hey, I want to do this thing different, or I think you can do a little better.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to come across like I'm telling somebody else how to do their job as a student. I realize I don't know much, so I would feel weird saying, hey, we should do this.
Well, you know a lot, but you just don't know it in context is what I usually tell students.
That word comes up a lot. One of my professors, a chair of our department, Sky Donovan, says that a lot. She said, you guys do know a lot, but it's the context that we lack. So we don't know where to insert this knowledge. So that's a good point. I've heard that a couple times. So talk to Shirley Sarman, and she talked about things coming and going in the PT world. And you had brought up something like dry needling, manual therapy, and fad PT treatment interventions. Things come and things go. Where does that fit in with PT? How do we figure out what's not a fad?
You know, I think this relates to our previous kind of topic of, you know, science and practice. And I think the more disciplined we are at training our students in the ethos, the philosophy of science, as well as basic science and mathematics and philosophy, these things self-write themselves. And it's coming. There are programs now who have a dual degree in bioengineering, mechanical engineering, and a DPT.
Wow.
So people will say things, and the dual degree person will be at CSM and raise their hand and say, you can't say that. That's not explicitly true. Or, well, what do you mean by when you say this word? So I think in that regard, the tide is maybe coming a little bit. But I think a lot of this comes back to the fact that if we go historically to our profession, if we look to history, which I think is important, we didn't grow number one, directly out of medicine. And we didn't grow directly out of a therapeutic discipline like counseling or psychology. We grew out of nursing. We started as a nursing specialty, and we grew into our own identity from there. And that's not bad. Nursing has a rich, rich history, and it's a fantastic profession. Without fail, I love my nursing colleagues to death. So that's not a critique of their profession. But the reason I bring that up is that we don't have a philosophical, foundational premise to what we do. We don't have that history like some of the other professions do. And I think we're seeking an identity. We're seeking what it is that we want to grab hold to. And what we first have to do is actually create a foundation. What is the foundation of our knowledge or our approach? And unfortunately, PTs, I have two, as a profession, my sense is that there's two things we do a lot. We have an inferiority complex because we always want to prove ourselves. Mm-hmm. We want to be this doctoring profession. We want to be respected. We want to have a seat at the table in healthcare, as it were. We want to be in the conversation. We want to make a difference. And the flip side is we love to do things on our own. We like to make new things up. What we need to do is, number one, get rid of the inferiority complex and realize that we are recognized in healthcare. We're well respected in healthcare. People just don't always understand exactly what we do. But we are in healthcare, baby, and you got to remember it. The physicians know it. The nurses know it. You come into the hospital, you ask anyone, they say, oh, PT's great. We have to have them. We need more of them. I want them to see all my patients multiple times a day. I want them to be on my rounds every day. We want the PTs, and this is true across hospitals, but we need to open our doors and say, okay, we've got this identity crisis. Who are the professions that can foundationally help us create and solve the problems that we have? What's interesting is PT kind of lives in this weird triangular intersection between medicine and psychology and mechanics or engineering or physics. Unfortunately, we're not that good at collaborating with either of the disciplines. And there will be people who argue with me with this, but our research, I think, proves this. And the example I'll give is that a mathematician gave me this example, by the way. It's not the physician who makes the chemotherapy drug, right? It's a chemist. They make the drug, but the physician's at the table and he has enough chemistry knowledge to be able to talk about it. But we are doing all the basic research into biomechanics. Where's the engineer? Where's the physicist? Where's the mechanist? The guy who actually has a PhD in mechanical engineering at that table. The flip side is, why are we not basing some of our professional identity in counseling and psychology? And I think sometimes as we've grown to try to be this direct access, high level doctoring profession, we've kind of capitalized the first word of our title, and we've kind of parentized and, you know, size 8 font the second word, which is therapist. You are a therapist. Mm-hmm. Inherently takes some counseling skills and some psychological background, right? And so I think if we pulled from some of these other professions, psychology, counseling, hard basic science, physics, mechanics, deeper into physiology and our medicine colleagues, we could really create a nice foundation. And that foundational approach and knowledge and philosophy will get rid of fad treatments. Because when fad treatments come up, when guruism takes flight, which happens all the time. There's gurus in every field. There's people who can dissent in an intelligent way. And so the reason that guruism or fad treatments come along is because they appear to make sense and they definitely appear to work. And then therefore we get latched onto it. And if you look at the history, especially of physical modalities, you can see this. Ultrasound, E-stem, E-stem with heat, iontophoresis, phonophoresis, you know, manipulation is going to cure all. Well, okay, we understand it a little better. You still should use it. Manual therapy seems great. It doesn't work how we thought. Dry needling is just the next bump on this fad treatment road. And that's not to say that maybe it doesn't do something. The data is fairly poor quality at this point. It's fairly underwhelming. We can learn a lot from acupuncture. And if we really take a step back and look at it just like manual therapy, I say all the time that dry needling is the new manipulation. It's not going away. PTs love it. And we will understand more and more about it all the time. And then we will finally realize it's not about the needle. It's not about where you stick it. It's about all these other crazy, mucked up, complicated human factors. Maybe we made a mistake by putting so much money into saying we should be able to do it. We're going to pay to get trained in it. It's going to cost us a lot of time and cognitive energy. Maybe that opportunity cost was spent better in other realms.
You also brought up a couple times, stop reading PT research. All you need is what we get before we even come to PT school, which is physics, physiology, and as you brought up just a second ago, psychology.
That's very true. I was interviewed a little while back about working with geriatric people and kind of some of my stuff in ICU. And I said, it comes down to the 3 P's. Physics, physiology, and psychology. And you take all of those things and we have what we need. I say this all the time, usually just to get a reaction out of people. Stop reading the PT research. And they say, well, what do you mean? And I say, Well, actually, if you want to look at being evidence-based on your evidence-based practice, the highest quality RCTs, and this is just RCT-level research on PT interventions, is not published in PT-specific journals. It's published in JAMA, Clinical Rehabilitation, Spine, The Lancet. Because as a researcher, you want to publish a high-impact study in a high-impact journal. And so therefore, it's usually outside the physical therapy realm. And that goes for both journals that publish the most RCTs and journals that publish the highest quality. Most of them are not PT journals. Not that PTJ is a bad journal. It's actually very high ranked in orthopedics and rehabilitation. It's a great journal, and they've actually had a commitment to getting more RCTs. But the flip side of that is all the foundational knowledge and all this other research that applies to practice isn't published in PT journals. I mean, the Journal of Pain, for example. I mean, I think that's a journal that PT should be paying attention to. Most of our clients, most of our patients, most of the people we interact with have either a primary or secondary complaint of pain. We should understand that. You know, you talk about behavior change, which is what therapists do, right? If anyone who you've ever interacted with, you're asking them to do something they normally don't do. We should understand things about behavior change. You know, if you talk about the physics and physiology of exercise and exercise interventions, a lot of that stuff is published in, you know, like Medicine and Science and Sports, or Medicine and Exercise and Sports, or Medicine and Science and Sports and Exercise, you know, all these physiologic and sports medicine and exercise physiology journals. You know, even the more medical journals, JAMA, Thorax, Circulation, Heart, American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care. I mean, all the stuff related to what I do is published in those journals. So we have to broaden our scope when we're talking about engaging the literature, as well as how we educate our students. And those are two separate issues.
So you're not saying stop reading research. What you're saying is get the research, but make sure it's not just PT research. Go outside.
Absolutely. And there's so much great stuff out there, honestly. And I can send you some resources on this. I've written about this before. Is if we actually dive into the data, most of the high quality PT RCTs are not published in PT journals, which means you can read all the PT journals and likely miss out on some humongous PT RCTs.
Because you're saying they just want to be published in the most prestigious or largest journal, which might not necessarily be a PT journal.
Absolutely. If you're a researcher, you know, what's important to you and what shows good scholarship and productivity is publishing in high impact journals. So if you have the option of PTJ or JAMA, it's not a knock on the PT profession. You're going to submit your manuscript to JAMA every day of the week and not think twice. And that's going to have more reach too, right?
Right.
It's a high-impact journal with a high readership.
But some PTs might miss out on it if we're not looking outside the PT research realm.
Absolutely.
All right, last question. What is the foundation of philosophy of PT? Kind of a history lesson. You touched on a little bit earlier, more of us having that psychological background coming from being rooted in nursing. So what's really the foundation of philosophy of PT?
It's a good question. You've identified a big problem because I would argue that currently we don't have one.
Okay.
And I would argue if you ask this question to 100 different physical therapists, you'd get 100 different answers. Most of them long-winded with a lot of different words in there and different things about movements and movement systems and all kinds of other things.
And that's not necessarily good because if it's a foundation of a profession, it should kind of be somewhat cohesive.
Sure. Well, there should be some similarity there. And I don't know if I have a good answer, but I think just the recognition that maybe we should work on going a level deeper and trying to identify and create some explicit things there, some explicit kind of fields or approaches or things that guide what we do at a philosophical level. And to me, it has to take in psychology and counseling. It has to take in basic science and mechanics, because if we're going to talk about movement, you're talking about physics. If we're talking about, you know, the movement of a human, you're talking about, at a really fundamental level, basic mechanics. So we need that. And then we also need physiology and medicine, because we're in healthcare. I think we bring those three things together and we decide what is it that we're all about. It's not necessarily the musculoskeletal system, but it is movement. But I wouldn't call it the movement system. And this is probably where Shirley Sarman and I would divulge a little bit. I would just call it movement. We're about human movement, and mostly we're about human movement in pathological or predicted pathological states. We have to kind of admit that at this point. I'm all for health and wellness and us being across the lifespan, but if you work in healthcare as a healthcare professional at this day and age, you have to admit that mostly what you deal with is pathology and the sequelae of it, and maybe the prevention of the exacerbation or even the prevention of it. But you deal mostly in pathology, and that's okay. And I think it's wrapping all of those things around human movement and human function. And how we do that, you know, I'm not sure. It's a big task, much more than a single beer can solve.
Yeah. Well, on that note, each one of our episodes is a pint, but before we leave, of course, you always have to do some shots. So our parting shots, if you wanted to give some advice to yourself before you were graduating from PT school, some people who are new grads, what's a parting shot you'd give?
That's a good question. I think the first one, I'm going to have a few parting shots.
Shot is never discounted here.
We're going to saddle up to the bar. We're going to take a few shots here. The first one is about uncertainty, and that is there's always, always, always going to be uncertainty there. And the sooner that you dive into that uncertainty and that you understand that it's always going to be there and you accept that feeling, you'll finally realize that there's not anywhere to get to. It's just a process to develop and go through. I'll read a quote from a famous journalist skeptic that I like. And he says, "The offer of certainty, the offer of complete security that can't give way, is an offer of something worth having. I want to live my life taking the risk all the time that I don't know anything like enough yet, that I haven't understood enough yet, that I can't know enough yet, that I'm always hungrily operating on the margins of a potentially great harvest of future knowledge and wisdom. I wouldn't have it any other way." And so I'd encourage myself in the past to say, that's where the diamonds are. That's where the harvest is going into that uncertainty and always, always asking the questions.
That feels good for students because a lot of times we lack the context. So I'm familiar with uncertainty. I'm not sure if I'm embracing it 100% yet. I definitely know it's there.
And I think that's part of developing clinical expertise, is not necessarily that you know more, it's you do. You realize what you do know a little bit better, but you know how much damn stuff you don't know, and you become a little more comfortable working in uncertainty and knowing that it's all uncertain, and even each patient is a dynamic process, and every day is a new day that requires a new assessment and new eyes and new lens and more uncertainty.
And that's got to keep the job at least interesting.
If you have that lens on, it's never a boring day, I can tell you that much.
I like that. Good parting shots right there. Appreciate you taking the time to talk with us. My feeling is this will not be the last beer that we share talking PT on a podcast. Thanks for taking the time out to talk with us on the PT Pintcast, man.
My pleasure.
We talk PT, drink beer, and record it. This is the PT Pintcast. The PT Pintcast is intended for educational purposes only. No clinical decision-making should be based solely on one source. While care is taken to ensure accuracy, factual errors can be present. Our lawyers made us read that.